This is the audio edition of Real Life, a magazine about living with technology. The emphasis is more on living. Discussions of UX tend to focus on how things look and how they work, but the way they sound or read is just as meticulously designed. Often, the aim of sounding human and being clear serves to disguise how interfaces are manipulative and skewed toward the company's interest, while also reinforcing biased, universalist assumptions. Look Who's Talking. How Tech Companies Understand Clarity Reveals What They Assume About Users, by Megan Mars. First, we learn to speak how computers seem to want us to. Best Pizza Chicago, we might type into the search bar, dropping yet another preposition. Hit submit, someone might say, punctuating a dreary task with a rhyme that sounds like two verbs but isn't. Now, computers sound increasingly like people. This isn't just a matter of Alexa and its competitors, or the chatbots that respond when you message brands. While the technologies that enable human-machine conversation, speech synthesis, natural language processing, have advanced a lot over the past decade, engineering alone can't yet breathe life into most interfaces. What is human-like in them is often due to the way they are written. User experience, UX, design, is the process of ensuring that websites, apps, and other products meet the needs of their intended users, at least to the extent that those needs can help generate revenue. Discussions of UX tend to focus on how things look, the color of a button, the placement of a menu, and how they work, what happens when you click or tap. But the way they sound or read is increasingly just as meticulously designed. UX writers, who may also have titles like product writer, content designer, or content strategist, do a lot of different things depending on where they work. They might write help content, emails, or error messages. We've seen this problem clear up with a restart of Slack, a solution which we suggest to you now only with great regret and self-loathing. They might script digital assistants and chatbots. What can I help you with? They might compose the text that tells you what will happen if you click on a link, button, or menu. Perhaps you've noticed that learn more is losing ground to more specific pleas like read the full story. When you use a consumer app, website, or device created by a large technology company, a UX writer has probably had a hand in the words you're interacting with. One of UX writing's main directives is to make interfaces sound human, natural, or conversational. Amazon's instructions for people writing Alexa scripts include tips like, quote, use variety to inject a natural and less robotic sound into a conversation and make repeat interactions sound less rote or memorized, end quote. Across organizations, guidelines urge the use of contractions, first and second person pronouns, in words that people on the other side of the device might say. Recently, when a cash register expressed hope that I'd had a good Target run, I thought, hey, that's what my mom calls it too. The writer for the self-checkout kiosks had hit their mark. Sarah Wachter-Becher, in her 2017 book Technically Wrong, dates the current, quote, talk like a human movement in tech products, end quote, to 2011. This was the year Apple launched Siri and IBM's Watson won Jeopardy. But Wachter-Becher doesn't mention these events. She thinks the email marketing company MailChimp kindled the trend with its then-new voice and tone guidelines. The guidelines, which soon started, quote, popping up in countless conference talks as the way forward for online communication, end quote, framed MailChimp's relationship with customers as explicitly conversational. They used speech bubbles to demonstrate the tone the company's writers should take for a variety of types of content. The idea was that MailChimp should modulate its voice, as a person would, depending on the situation of whomever it was talking to. All the while, the voice itself should remain recognizable. MailChimp defined this voice as having 8 consistent parameters, the first 2 of which were, quote, fun but not childish, and, quote, clever but not silly. Other apps and websites followed suit. many with voices more obtrusive than MailChimp's. Critics zeroed in on the silliness. In a 2016 essay for Real Life, Jesse Barron pointed out that apps like Yelp and Seamless spoke in the voice of a, quote, cool babysitter practicing cuteness applied in the service of power concealment, end quote. Wachter Betcher makes similar critiques of pop-ups with cleverly passive-aggressive opt-outs. No thanks, this deal is just too good for me. And notifications that are inappropriately fun, like Tumblr's infamous beep beep trending tag is here, which notified users about tags like hashtag neo-Nazis and hashtag mental illness. Clever copy, she writes, quote, wraps tech's real motives, gaining access to more information, making us more dependent on their services, in a cloak of cuteness that gently conditions us to go along with whatever's been plunked down in front of us, end quote. Like we're being run over by a pink bulldozer, as my friend Monica put it. But the bulldozer is no longer quite so pink. While cuteness is not dead, Tumblr still uses beep beep, it is waning. In 2013 and 14, the email confirmations I received from Grubhub, Seamless's parent company, began, hip hop hooray, a whole heap of delicious is on the way. By 2017, the messages went straight to the point. We've confirmed your delivery order from restaurant. Your food should be ready by time. Groupon made a similar switch. Once known for voicey coupons, it now describes deals with a single plain-faced sentence. Like most trends, the interface speech patterns of the early and mid-2010s have come to seem dated. Hip-hop hooray? Perhaps more significant, plainer writing in apps and on websites better approximates the sort of face-to-face conversations it replaces. If we're helping someone buy something or rendering them a service, we're probably not, with some exceptions, trying to show off our inner selves. Wachter Betcher quotes MailChimp executive Kate Kiefer-Lee, who says she thought the company had been, quote, trying too hard to be entertaining, and was now focusing, quote, on clarity over cleverness and personality. MailChimp's voice has since gotten an overhaul. If a company's voice expresses how it thinks of itself, its definition of clarity expresses how it thinks of its users. UX writers tend to follow human-centered design practices, which, depending on the situation and your perspective, aim to solve problems people actually have or convince them they have problems in need of solving. The way for writers to accomplish either goal is usually to make things clearer. Clear language can and often does make apps less frustrating, forms more inclusive, and websites more accessible to more people. But clarity can also structure how we think about technology without our understanding or noticing. To warn UX writers against using this power irresponsibly, the handbook Writing is Designing, 2020, by Michael J. Metz and Andy Welfel, quotes information architect Jorge Arango. Quote, if you are the person who controls the form of the environment by defining its boundaries through language, you can ensure that persuasion will happen without me even knowing it's happening, end quote. However well-intentioned an individual writer might be, the main point of this persuasion is almost always going to be profit. In a foreword for the 2012 edition of the popular handbook Content Strategy for the Web, Facebook's first content strategist, Sarah Kunsella, mentions that she revised a few links at the bottom of the homepage to make them, quote, clearer and more compelling, end quote. The increased clarity appears to have come largely from placing mobile and find friends at the beginning of the list, and it's telling what Kunsella cites as proof of this, quote, 6 million more people found friends, invited friends, and tried Facebook mobile every week, purely as a result of those tiny improvements, end quote. For UX writing teams, clarity often means making what the company wants you to do, try mobile, find friends, the clear choice for you. Clarity promotes not only corporate-friendly actions, but corporate-friendly, i.e. superficial, understandings of the world. For example, Metz and Welfel praise Pinterest's terms of service for including, quote, a summary of each section in simple terms, to help users understand what they're agreeing to, end quote. To illustrate, they excerpt a paragraph of legalese that ends with a more simply put translation, which reads, quote, Pinterest has links to content off of Pinterest. Most of that stuff is awesome, but we're not responsible when it's not, end quote. Like a lot of clear writing found in apps and on websites, these sentences seem more likely to make people feel like they understand than to ensure they actually do. Most of that stuff is awesome does not have the same implication as what the legalese actually says. We don't endorse any of it. Risk, the legal term, is not the same as mere lack of awesomeness, and the replacement of no liability with we're not responsible, instead of something like you won't be able to sue us, makes the stakes for the user less clear, not more, preemptively replacing whatever you might have thought with what the company wants you to think. Of course, clarity, as Metz and Welful acknowledge, is in the eye of the beholder, as is usefulness, as is what sounds human. These concepts, as they appear in style guides, how-to articles, and guidebooks for UX writers, are often presented as universal ideals. Like mainstream journalistic objectivity, however, they are not the neutral values they pretend to be. What human and clear share as interface writing values is not only that they find expression in common words and simple sentences, but that they can easily become vessels for the kind of false universality that merely imposes one powerful group's interests on everyone else and asks them to feel good about it. This kind of problem has been embedded in personal computing from the start. Cynthia L. Self and Richard J. Self Jr.'s 1994 article, The Politics of the Interface, Power and Its Exercise in Electronic Contact Zones, details how interfaces can reinforce sexist, racist, classist, and colonialist hierarchies. They observe, for example, that by using the desktop as its organizing metaphor, the personal computer fails to, quote, represent the world in terms of a kitchen countertop, a mechanic's workbench, or a fast food restaurant, each of which would constitute the virtual world in different terms according to the values and orientations of, respectively, women in the home, skilled laborers, or the rapidly increasing numbers of employees in the fast food industry. End quote. Since then, biased interfaces have abounded. Wachter Becher's book, subtitled Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech, is a useful compendium of recent examples. The Etsy push notification that assumed women would want to shop for him on Valentine's Day, the Facebook real name requirements that deemed many Native American names fake and endangered drag queens and kings, the many forms that still needlessly require you choose one of two genders. These are the front-end counterparts of the racist and sexist algorithms that have been all over the news for the past decade or so. The predictive software that erroneously links race to the probability of committing a crime. The search engines that for years ranked porn sites at or near the top of results for queries like black girls and Latinas. And in some cases still do, if the test searches I just did on Bing are any indication. Google appears to have corrected for this. In her 2018 book Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism, Safia Noble argues that racist and sexist search results are so insidious in part because search engines are, quote, allegedly neutral technologies, end quote, having socialized us into believing that they provide, quote, accurate information that is depoliticized, end quote, they lend credibility to their own harmful results. Google has nurtured its neutral image by de-emphasizing human involvement in search and playing up its reliance on machines. According to a passage Wachter Becher recounts from Stephen Levy's In the Plex, 2011, Marissa Mayer once rejected a design at Google because, in Mayer's words, quote, it looks like a human was involved in choosing what went where. It looks too editorialized, end quote. Today, following a stream of high-profile criticism and media investigations into the disastrous effects of many algorithms, machines might be starting to seem less trustworthy. Since the 2016 U.S. election season, when commentators widely blamed major platforms and their algorithms for the spread of fake news, Facebook, Twitter, and Google have all taken steps to minimize disinformation. A 2019 Google white paper describing the company's efforts emphasizes that humans still never choose where a link appears in search results. It has merely changed its algorithms to better prioritize authoritative sources. But many of the changes the paper describes, such as the addition of knowledge panels, make Google's products look more editorialized. More recently, the company's special COVID-19 search results pages have gone further, separating results into clearly labeled categories like top stories and local news, and adding a sidebar menu with links like testing, treatments, and prevention. The overall vibe is that you're on a site like WebMD or MayoClinic.org. Google achieves this effect with labels that look like they were written by a human, and in some cases probably were. In any case, the company seems to have bet that clear and human-sounding products might now convey a more trustworthy form of neutrality than products that appear to be produced and overseen entirely by machines. Meanwhile, as Noble argues, quote, algorithmic oppression is not just a glitch in the system, but rather is fundamental to the operating system of the web, end quote. And clear, humanoid voices can legitimate it just as efficiently, perhaps now more efficiently, as mechanical neutrality can. In their chapter on developing voices for companies and products, Metz and Welfel highlight Airbnb, which defines its voice as straightforward, inclusive, thoughtful, and spirited. To show how these qualities are expressed in practice, they offer a screenshot of an Airbnb page about safety, including a section on watch list and background checks. The section reads, in full, quote, while no screening system is perfect, globally we run hosts and guests against regulatory, terrorist, and sanctions watch lists. For hosts and guests in the United States, we also conduct background checks. End quote. This probably doesn't feel inclusive to a formerly incarcerated person whose account Airbnb deactivated after a background check. And it might not feel straightforward for someone who wonders whether the background checking companies Airbnb works with, whose names it has declined to provide, will use biased algorithms in their risk evaluations. The language, while syntactically clear, will be opaque to many people with a stake in the information it pretends to convey. What it actually communicates is that Airbnb prioritizes those who comfortably assume they have no reason to worry that discriminatory practices would exclude them. In this respect, it is all too human. Megan Mars has previously written about technology and language for The Baffler and The Washington Post. This essay was published at reallifemag.com on July 16, 2020. Real Life Audio Edition is narrated and produced by Brittany Gill. Our music is by Secret Wilderness. You can find more essays about living with technology on our website and follow us on Twitter at _RealLifeMag. Thanks for listening.